Welcome to Directly Speaking, a direct-to-consumer marketers podcast. Our podcast features marketing leaders in the direct-to-consumer and e-commerce space. We get to learn a bit about their brands and the stories behind them, compare notes and trends and challenges in the industry, learn how they approach their marketing journey, and hopefully a little bit about them personally. I'm your host, Marcus Lancaster, Head of Direct-to-Consumer Strategy at Quad, and I'm very excited about today's guest, Philip Glaser, Marketing Manager at Bowman Hat Company. Philip is a seasoned digital marketing strategist with over a decade of experience in crafting results-driven campaigns across various digital platforms. Philip's approach is deeply analytical, utilizing data insights to optimize marketing efforts and deliver measurable outcomes. He lives in Richmond, Virginia with his wife and two children. Philip, thank you so much for being here today.
Absolutely, Marcus. Thanks for having me.
It's so great to have you. Let's start by talking about your brand. You know, when we met a few weeks ago, one of the things you shared with me that resonated is that you tell your friends you work for a hat company that you've never heard of. Let's start out with that. Why don't you tell us about Bowman Hat Company and the brands that you guys represent?
Yeah, sure. So I work for the Bowman Hat Company, which is one of the oldest continuous operating businesses in the United States. Been making hats in Pennsylvania since 1868. So over 150 years of time. No one's ever heard of the Bowman Hat Company. We make hats for a variety of brands. The ones most people have heard of is Kangle and Bailey are two, along with Helen Kaminsky. And we operate a number of websites, direct-to-consumer websites. Hats.com is one of them. Kangle.com and BaileyHats.com are the three I'm most intimately involved in.
Very cool. All right. Let's just take one more step and go one level lower, and let's talk about the specific brands. I know Kangle's kind of like a street brand, kind of an urban street brand, right? Tell us a little bit about that and Bailey and the rest of the brands.
Yeah, so Kangle is, as you said, its roots are an urban street brand. You know, it's like a lot of businesses. It's got an interesting mix of consumers, but tends to trend younger. Hats are a little bit lower of a price point. And Kangle is our most well-known, people know Samuel L. Jackson, people know Eminem wears the Kangle Army cap. That's pretty much the only hat you'll ever see him in. So it's a well-known in, the celebrity culture. Bailey Hats is, an interesting brand. It's also a very old brand, started in California, and they have a line of fashion hats, and they have a line of very successful Western hats. For people who are not in the headwear space or maybe have been sleeping under a rock and not watched Yellowstone, Western hats are on fire.
I continue
to see unbelievable growth year over year. And, it's one of those things that you keep thinking it's going to end and it doesn't. So excited about that.
You lead to a question that is probably worth asking. So if you're talking about the Bailey side of the business, you have kind of different customers in there. You probably have people interested in Western wear that really need performance Western wear. And then you have people that are more in the fashion side of that play.
Absolutely. And that's one of our big marketing challenges, right? So Western is a very interesting niche in the headwear space and in the apparel space in general, where you have the rancher, the outdoor, the oil platform worker. These are people who their headwear is part of their daily, work wardrobe. It is a functional piece first and foremost. Fashion comes second. And that business has always been really strong for us, but the growth has come from what I like to call the faux Western, right? So these are people who, whether it's your Beyonce wearing, a bright red cowboy hat with her new album, whether it's obviously in Hollywood, it's a big push towards Western, Nashville, Austin, Texas. I call that faux Western. And that's not, obviously we'll take all those customers and we want to find them the perfect Western hat. But it's an interesting marketing challenge because cattle rancher in Wyoming does not want to see Nashville girl on bachelorette party in any marketing. So you have to have very distinct messaging and you have to be very careful to be authentic with your core Western customer. Now, the positive of this is that faux Western customer I spoke of, they're excited to see imagery and messaging driven towards, ranch guy and ranch gal. Like they don't mind that at all. It's just, we just can't go the other way.
Gotcha. So let me ask you, when you're, it's once a customer is inside the organization and you have that, first party data and zero party data, and they've been buying from you, of course, whether they fall into the faux Western or authentic Western buckets, But what about somebody who isn't already in your funnel?
Yeah, so that's a challenge, right? I mean, like everything is a challenge. Data is a challenge and how you use data to make decisions. And so segmentation obviously is a big part of every modern e-commerce operation. And sure. We try really hard based on browsing patterns and things of that nature. We can pretty accurately put you into a couple of different buckets. And so the person who has crossover browsing between our fashion lines and our Western lines is more likely not the true core Western customer. So that's one of the easiest ways to do it. And then we just make sure we don't send imagery to people who are only browsing predominantly Western styles. And obviously, if you've bought from us before, we know very accurately which of those two silos you're in. And some of this is, there's a lot of crossover from the fashion side to that faux Western customer. So as long as we just keep the core Western rancher, cattleman, things like that in a separate silo, it works out just fine. But then again, another thing that you can tell is, hats, especially high-end fashion-driven hats, have a relatively long purchase horizon. These are not something that someone's going to walk into a store and spend hundreds of dollars on a cowboy hat for giggles, and then buy another one next week and another one next week. So, again, we talked about this briefly before, but one of our constant struggles is most modern e-com best practices are geared towards a very high purchase frequency. Yes. Skincare's got one set of frequency, pet food, even regular apparel. You may own a dozen polo shirts or quarter zips like what you've got on. You may buy 4 or 5 of those in any given year, where the average person is not going to buy multiple high dollar, high end fashion hats. They're more either need based or event based. So a need based is I'm a rancher and I wore it out after 2 years. I need a new one. And need based would be I'm going to a wedding. My son's getting married in Bermuda and I want to have a great straw hat for a beach wedding. So most of our purchasers kind of fall into either of those two camps.
Got it.
Which is just another interesting struggle for us, or challenge for us, I should say.
Interesting. So with maybe kind of high consideration purchase, then, first question is, do you guys quantify how many touches you need with a client before they'll convert?
We do, but like everything, you can look at the averages and it tells you one number, but then if you subset the data, it looks totally different. So it's a lot. Somewhere north of 6 or 7 for most people. But again, you get skewed by the people who come into our site every day for 2 months and finally make a purchase. And then there's the average person, the occasional person who will log on and go, $400, no problem, I want it, click. So it's a very interesting, I talk a lot about data in my day-to-day life, and I talk about how making decisions based on data. And this is an interesting one where if you look at averages versus means, they're very different. And so you've got to really try to look at that data in a segmented way so that how the different kinds of consumers are making decisions.
Can you say more about this? So do you align that data by the various segments that purchase? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's our goal. Again, and no data is perfect. And that's, as data laws become tighter and people become tighter with how they're sharing data, it's kind of a constant cat and mouse game. But, I like to look at, I look at trends versus numbers. It's something I talk a lot about. You can look at a website, say it gets 100,000 visitors. Well, does it actually get 100,000 visitors? I don't know. But as long as we're measuring the same way, if it was 100,000 last month and it's 120,000 this month, that's positive.
It's trending positive.
I look at trend lines more than I fix it in actual numbers, which I talk to a lot of marketing people and they're so fixated on open rates and things like that. And open rates and email is kind of a phony number nowadays. It's not, you can't rely on that at all.
Correct. Very true. Okay. The couple questions I want to dive into there, sure. Two different directions. First, you've got a wholesale business is probably the lion's share of your business and a direct to consumer business. Do you see customers bouncing before or browsing on your website and then converting in store?
There certainly is some of that. Again, that's where the data part gets really challenging because we don't get great data from the vast majority of our wholesale accounts.
I was wondering.
We do sell to, Macy's and Nordstrom's and some very sophisticated companies, but we also sell to Marcus's Hat Shop in, Dearborn, Michigan, and things like that. That you're lucky if you get sell-through data alone, let alone anything else that's actually, you know, impactful from a decision-making perspective. Obviously, we can look at what sells on both the wholesale side and direct-to-consumer side. So you can get some trends in terms of marketing that way. But one of the, you know, this is in modern direct-to-consumer, right? You have to marry providing a brand experience for someone who's not going to buy from you on your website. And you have to provide that service for your wholesale accounts. And we constantly try to think about how we interact with our brick and mortar partners to make sure that customers are comfortable buying there or buying with us. You know, obviously, typically the direct-to-consumer advantage is we have a wider variety of styles and colors, and we have a wider variety of sizes. So if you're looking for a black cowboy hat, chances are you can get that a lot of different places relatively simply. No matter where you live in the country, there's a place that's going to sell that near you. But if you're looking for a bright pink cowboy hat in an incredibly either small or large size or things like that, your choices in store are going to be a lot less. So we tend to sell online a larger percentage of our bookend sizes, the extra smalls and the extra, extra larges. We tend to sell a lot more of the non-core colors, only because that's what we offer that the brick and mortar store simply can't stock that kind of variety.
Right. Okay. So if indeed you dive into something else there that I think is that resonates, especially with direct to consumer brands these days, all media has to serve more than one function. It has to be both brand and conversion data. So that's probably changed the way you guys approach the media that you provide.
Oh, absolutely. And part of it is you want to provide a seamless checkout experience. So if someone's ready to make a purchase, you've got to make that easy. And I think that was maybe even 10 years ago, that was not a trend in direct-to-consumer websites. It almost was like the fact that a brand would sell directly to consumers was, it was not a dirty little secret, but it was still not the primary focus of a lot of websites. You know, nowadays, I'll take any conversion someone's going to offer up. So if anybody's ready or willing to purchase, we have to make that part seamless. But you also have to provide a rich visual experience that builds on what the brand is. And so that is, you know, it could be as simple as copy being on brand and things like that. All that stuff, it's almost like you've got to be perfect now. You know, during the COVID years, you could put up a simple Shopify website, run a couple of pay-per-click ads, and sell just about anything. But one, the consumer nowadays has become much more sophisticated. They can smell something that doesn't feel quite right very quickly. Even if they can't tell you what's wrong with a website, it feels not great. It feels dated. It feels scammy. So you got to make sure all those bullet points are aligned. You know, providing someone does want to make a purchase, we're happy to take it. But if they're going to go to our partner retailers in whatever, you know, city or state, we want them to make that part that process, you know, easy and compelling as well.
There is so much more competition these days, and the consumer has learned, has seen what good is in e-commerce experiences. So therefore, their level of expectation about you serving them relevant content and relevant product is higher than ever.
And where I would challenge, which I agree with what you said, but the only thing I would add is the word sophisticated. There's much more sophisticated competition these days. You know, everybody was doing really low budget e-com in the teens into the, you know, up through the late 20 teens. Nowadays, people expect customer service. They expect to have a phone number they can pick up and call. They expect to be able to send an email and get a response in a reasonable, you know, period of time. And so that's where I think the change has come, is everybody's gotten much more sophisticated, which has made paid media much more challenging and much more expensive, because, you know, 6 years ago, nobody was doing a great job across many, many niches in terms of really dialed in pay-per-click or really dialed in retargeting ads on Meta. No one was doing that very well. Obviously, there were a handful of brands that did it at a very high level. That's always been the case. You know, the Nikes, the Yetis, these huge brands with huge teams, and they've got floors full of people working on emails and floors full of people working on paid media. They've always done a good job. But now even the smaller to medium size, you know, e-commerce sites, which is where I classify us, everybody at that level is sophisticated now. Everybody at that level is, you know, got a paid media 101 type operation going. So they're not going to make clumsy mistakes like that was happening, you know, 5-6 years ago.
One more question about customer experience before we proceed would be, What do you see AI and how are you guys using it to help, you know, provide the customer with a relevant experience?
So, you know, like everybody who works in direct to consumer, I've been hearing about AI now for years. And every year they say this is the year or next year is the year. It's getting much closer, but it's not there yet. You know, we do use AI to help drive merchandising-based decisions, which is, I think, a really easy use case for it.
Sure.
We use AI, obviously, from a planning perspective. Again, this is where ChatGPT has like changed the game for me, is you can log in, you're feeling kind of stumped on a marketing question or copywriting question. Give me 10 headlines, less than 12 words about this. And then as a, you know, so the skill set's really moved more to editing, right? So you take 10 okay ideas and you pull apart a couple of good ones to create something compelling. And that's where, you know, we're using AI all the time for that kind of stuff, image generation. What's exciting to me about AI, which I don't think we're there yet, is getting to the true one-on-one experience. So Marcus, you come on our site and through a handful of clicks and what model pictures we look at, we can get a pretty good idea of what you're looking for. And then we use AI to deliver a true one-on-one experience. We're not there yet. I think maybe the very biggest brands are, when I go to conferences, I hear about this incredible software that's all incredibly expensive.
Yeah, so for sure.
The analogy I always use is keyless entry started in the most expensive Mercedes. And, you know, 10 years later, keyless entry was a standard product across automobile manufacturers. We're going to see something very similar to that. The big, big brands with huge budgets and huge teams are going to be the first ones to crack the AI code. And then it'll trickle down to the medium size and smaller brands.
All right. Pivot a little bit. Let's go tactically. I think part of the reason that we first talked about engaging is the kind of the trends you're seeing in PPC and some of the way you have approached PPC and specifically how you've kind of managed upward, if you will, inside your organization about how to approach it. Let's talk about your PPC strategy and kind of how that ROAS looks and kind of how you go about it.
Sure. So like everybody who's doing this for a living, you know, PPC has gotten more expensive and more competitive. So sure, you can't look at what you did in April last year. It's not a good barometer. You've almost got to look week to week and month to month because that's how fast the price is changing. So I work for a company that is wholesale first, and we're a very old established company. So, you know, if you're working for somewhere that just started an e-com brand and that's your core business, you may not have these challenges. But like a lot of people, I have a PPC budget, and you're going to spend X dollars per month, which I then break down into a daily and a weekly spend. And over the course of, you know, probably 6 to 8 months, I had conversations with our leadership team and our accounting team about decoupling what we're spending from a line item in the budget. And instead, we're going for a ROAS target. So we have a target and a floor. And, you know, we put a process in place. We test it over the course of about 2 months to make sure, you know, all of our concepts actually worked out the way we thought they would. And we've dramatically increased what we've spent on PPC, but we've been able to maintain, you know, roughly a 15x ROAS, which, you know, I'm very comfortable with that.
That's great.
In 2024, my floor is somewhere between 12 and 13x. And it made a lot of people in my company very, very uncomfortable. This was all new and it was scary. And the accountants, you know, didn't love it first. And we've got some, you know, really dynamic leadership at our company that is willing to try new things and willing to take risks. And part of this is the beauty of PPC is you can take risks in the 1 week time horizon. So you're not talking about huge capital outlays that you won't know how it worked for months down the line.
Was that part of the way you sold it? Is that you weren't putting a lot of dollars at risk?
100%. And part of it is, you know, there's this old saying, Marcus, that I'm sure you've heard, and 50% of marketing works and 50% doesn't. And the trick is knowing which is which.
Which one?
Well, in digital marketing nowadays, that's not really true. You know, I can launch 3 PPC campaigns, and once Google's algorithm does its thing, so it's not instantaneously, but after 6, 7, 8 days, you have a pretty good idea if you're going to work or not, you know, and then you can, you know, like, so what we do is we throw a ton of things out into the water and then we start, what are the fish biting on? And then how can we optimize that approach? You may try 4 or 5 broad concepts in, you know, 3 bomb, 1's okay, and 1's pretty good. Once you have pretty good, you can build on, iterate pretty quickly, you know, through A/B testing and just trying new slight variations of what you know already works.
So it sounds like the sale wasn't as hard, partially because there was a limited amount of time, but also partially because your leadership is willing to go on an adventure, if you will, for trying new stuff.
That's a big part of it. And then, you know, we get to the point where we just put in a process in place that makes everybody feel comfortable, right? So we're going to check in every single day for the first 2 weeks, you know, okay. And part of this is manage expectations. The first week, don't expect dramatic changes. It never works like that. Whenever you shift what you're spending on Google, whenever you make a massive change, it takes some time for their algorithms to kind of figure it all out and optimize a little bit on the back end.
Yeah.
So then it starts with, don't worry, every morning I'm going to log in at 8 a.m. and I'm going to check how yesterday went. And we're going to make sure we're comfortable and nothing dramatic happened. And then it's every Tuesday I'm going to send you an email. This is how last week was. And you just start putting these little processes in place. And finally, you know, you get an email back that says, you're doing great. I don't need to hear about this anymore. Everybody gets comfortable. And then it's, else can we take the same approach? So we primarily did this on PPC, but now we're doing it on more paid social. And it's really, frankly, it's been a lever we've been able to pull in a very challenging e-com environment that's moved the needle.
And I really like that. I especially like you talking about the process there, because I'm continually talking to marketers that are continually challenged by talking to the finance side of their organization about convincing them that marketing is an investment, not a cost center.
100%. And I think a lot of it, marketers see something that to them looks very black and white. Like, this is a no-brainer decision. Of course we should do that. But the same way, whatever niche you're in, you probably use terms in your day-to-day work life that the average person has no idea what you're talking about, whether it's
Correct.
PPC, paid social, what does that even mean? So a lot of this is you have to really simplify it and try to have a conversation like you would have with someone who has absolutely no knowledge. And I think many marketers have this preconceived, like, they'd be an idiot not to say yes. And you got to get that part out, because the sales job is convincing everybody that, one, it's a good choice to take a worthy experiment. And then, two, you're going to put systems and processes in place. So if it doesn't go well, you limit your downside.
Got it. All right. Well, let's pivot a little bit to measurement. You know, you're saying you have to touch somebody 6 or 7 times on average before they convert. And, you know, in some cases, attribution might be kind of easy. But how do you go about attribution and determine what's working?
So that's the million-dollar question, right? That is the part of digital marketing that is still somewhat guesswork, somewhat some art and some science. And so I touched on it briefly earlier. I fix it on trends. You know, just to dumb this down really simply, if I look at my ESP, my email service provider, what they say revenue is, and I look at Google Analytics and what they say revenue is, and I look at Google Ads and what they say revenue is, they're never going to add up. It's just not going to happen. You know, obviously, we know what our actual sales numbers are, because that's actual, you know, we get the numbers from finance. This is what the actual transaction count was and the actual revenue brought in. So I try to look at it like looking at a pie, and I want to grow certain parts of the pie, and I want to put less emphasis on other parts of the pie based on what's working. And that could be how much it cost, you know, to acquire the customer. That could also be, you know, there's a staff time associated with this. We have a graphic designer. We have people who help post social stuff. So every time these people touch things, it costs more money.
Sure.
So like on paper, email looks like it's got this unbelievable ROAS. It's a relatively low cost thing. You know, the software's relatively low cost. It generates great revenue. So it looks like a slam dunk. But you got to think about how much internal time it takes to execute an email campaign or to execute, you know, a simple SMS send. There's a lot of touch points for that. So again, how do I look at it? It's all about trend lines. You know, are we moving in the right direction? I don't fixate as much on, you know, Meta says we did $10,000 last month and this month they say it's $8,000. I look at that's a 20% decrease, which is significant. Let's look at that. You know, and we rely heavily on Google Analytics only because I trust that Google's not going to change their attribution model without telling you. I don't trust the same with Meta. I don't trust the same with affiliates. So some of this is you've got to, you know, this is where you've got to kind of sift through the nuggets and try to find actual gold, which sometimes it's easy to find and sometimes it's not. I still think the world is changing incredibly fast. And one of the things that we talk about internally a lot is getting back to the basics, like the e-com 101, really basic stuff. I think so many people, and we were definitely in this camp, fixated on the latest statistical trends and the latest, you know, whether it's AI or whatever, just lean into the newest stuff. And I think a lot of people have lost track of, do you provide a good user experience? How's your welcome series? You know, welcome series in email or SMS is Ecom 101. Is it good? Could it be better? Are you A/B testing right? You know, how often are you A/B testing your send times for emails? We try to do it once a quarter. Is that enough? Maybe we should do it more often. You know, so these are the kinds of things that we're really fixated on getting back to, making sure we've got all of the basic stuff really, really tight. So that's the stuff, you know, for us, incrementality, which that's a really tough word to say. It's really important. It's not going to be huge percentage swings. Like, is it going to move my conversion rate by 10 or 15%? It's not.
I understand. So, well, and to your point about trends, trends make sense. And if you're looking at any given channel, again, you're right about Meta and the willingness to change the attribution model without notice. But in a general sense, if you look at trends, you're going to be able to follow them. What an incrementality study is going to do for you is only going to be able to really dive into what those levers, how those levers work together. But if you're comfortable with the trends you're doing, you should be in good shape.
Yeah. And that's, again, it just gets back to time, right? You know, if you're a Nordstrom or a Yeti or these huge brands, obviously they're going to have people who do that. And it makes a ton of sense to fix on it. But if you're, you know, we like to say we're a lean, mean operation. And if you're a small team, there's just not enough hours in the day. And there's always, you know, a crisis that needs to get fixed or something very significant that can move the needle for a large swath of your customers.
I understand. Very cool. All right. How about you yourself? Let's kind of pivot a little bit. You seem to really love your job. You seem to love data, but what gets you up in the morning? What are some things that energize you?
Yeah, I mean, data is a big thing, right? Like, I love, my favorite thing in the world is to look at a huge set of data, whether it's an Excel spreadsheet or whether it's a, you know, an online-based portal, and find a nugget that nobody else knew. And I think this is what's really cool about 2024 marketing is there are nuggets that the average person in an e-com operation does not know. Everybody talks about conversion rates and things like that, but there's tons of little things, customer journeys, you know, how often someone clicks the icon to get back to the homepage. Like, these are very meaningful things that you can make very meaningful improvements to your user experience based on simple data. And it's allowing us to make better business decisions. And that's,
I understand.
I think in a time of a lot of challenges, being able to make good business decisions that make sense for the bottom line. I mean, we're all in this to turn a profit. I want to provide a great customer experience and I want to do all those things too. But if no one, if there's nothing left over at the end of all of this, then the lights aren't going to be on for very long.
Correct.
And so that's the stuff that really fires me up. And, you know, I used to get excited by the shiny new software and the shiny new object. But as I've gotten a little bit older, a little bit more experienced, there's a lot of headaches that come with shiny too. So I've kind of moved beyond wanting the shiny new thing. And now it's getting back to the basics of really wanting to do good e-commerce. So before I worked at Bowman, I did a couple years of consulting kind of during COVID. It was the right fit for me and my family. And I got to work with a bunch of different brands and a bunch of different niches. And you'll learn a lot talking to different people, and their worldview is different based on what they're selling, how much it costs, what their fulfillment looks like, the different product niches that they're in. And so I still love talking marketing. Like, this, to me, these kinds of conversations are empowering because you get excited about.
Me too.
You get out of the drudgery, the day-to-day drudgery of like getting through your emails and getting through your inbox of whatever ticketing software you use. You know, this is very different. And so that's what excites me, is talking marketing, back to basics, doing the basics really, really well, and digging through, you know, all the various data stuff that's out there and trying to find real good gold nuggets.
I love that. How do you think our jobs are going to be different 2, 3, 4 years from now?
I think they're going to be dramatically different. You know, I think the middle is where, you know, middle management is where it's going to change. I think you're always going to need thought leaders who drive you in a direction. You're North Star. That's always going to be a thing. AI is not going to replace that. AI is not going to replace brand direction for a long time. And I think there's some remedial stuff that AI can solve, but I still find you still need to build an email. AI can't do that. You still need to click and add links and all those things. So I think entry level will be around for a long time. And I think, you know, the more advanced senior leadership will be around for a long time. What the middle looks like, it's going to be the wild, wild west. And so I think the person who can interact with software in an efficient way and pull out meaningful information, that's the future of mid-level marketing.
All right, not work. What are you into?
I love to cook. I love to eat. I love to hang with friends, have a fire, social gatherings, some adult beverages. You know, for me, I love building relationships, whether that's professionally or personally. I get fulfillment out of having people in my sphere that I enjoy being around.
Absolutely.
You know, I get joy from, I love to talk about people's jobs and not in the drudgery, but like, you know, one of my good friends, they build high-end temporary structures for sporting events. And like, I love spending an hour talking about that. I don't know anything about that. I wouldn't have even said that's a job. I had a conversation this past weekend with one of my daughter's gymnastics coaches, and her husband is the national sales manager for a fire hydrant manufacturer, which again,
wow, who knew?
Obviously, that's, if you think about that, someone's got to do that job. But yeah. I'm like, tell me more. Are you mid-level? Are you high-end? I mean, are there options? How does this work? Do you call the county and just say, how many do you need this year? So that's what I love, is just, you know, constant learning, constantly trying to get better. And I think the secret to a rich life is to have a bunch of different kind of information in your head. And however you want to get that, whether it's through reading or conversations, my preferred method, that's how I feel a rich life, is having deep, meaningful conversations about a bunch of different things and trying to learn more all the time. You've lost some of those interpersonal connections that you would have made. Oh, my husband does this. My wife does this. My son is at XYZ college studying to be a whatever thing I've never heard of before. And so you've lost some of that. So I've really had to go outside of the work world to try to develop those relationships. And it's, you know, my kids are old enough now that they're not a lot of high, you know, I have an 11-year-old and 9-year-old. They're not super high maintenance from a, you know, you're not watching them every moment. So now when we go to a neighborhood party, you can have conversations and you can, you know, things like that.
Very cool. All right, Philip, if somebody wants to get hold of you, what's the best way to do it?
Yeah, so very simple. My email is philip@hats.com. Very simple.
Perfect. Well, I want to thank you for joining us today. It was such a pleasure. It's been a pleasure getting to know you better, and I'm really excited to keep talking to you.
All right, Marcus. Have a great day. I'll talk to you soon.
And thank you for joining us on Directly Speaking this week, everybody. We really appreciate your participation and involvement and getting to know Philip a little bit better with us. Until next time, have a great day.